Hey, before we get started with this episode, industry leader, voice of reason, and good friend of the show, Derek Walker, been a guest and probably will be again. He's been given an unexpected diagnosis of cancer. Now, if he's provided the proper treatment, this should be totally fully recoverable, and our thoughts and prayers are with you, Derek. If you're listening and you're able, please join us in contributing to this fund to cover the costs of his treatment. There's a GoFundMe set up. You can go there and search for the Derek Walker Surgery Fund or look for the link directly from the show notes or on our Twitter account, which we'll be posting today. Thanks for listening and enjoy this episode.
This is the Strategy Inside Everything. I'm Adam Pierno.
All right, welcome back to another episode of the Strategy Inside Everything. I'm looking forward to today's conversation with Neil Parker. He is the co-founder and chief strategy officer at Co Collective. That's an agency or a company that I admire very much. Neil, how are you today?
Hey, doing well. Doing well. Glad to be here.
It's really great to meet you, and I'm looking forward to our conversation. It's funny, I just kind of stuttered over how to describe Co Collective. How do you describe it?
We see ourselves as a transformation partner, basically.
Okay. Yeah. So not agency.
Not agency. We sweat over that term, right? We're kind of somewhere between an agency and a consultancy, and we don't like either term. So fundamentally, we're partners to our clients.
Yeah. And both of them come with baggage, both of those terms.
Absolutely. They're both born of the past, right? And we're trying to build something for the future, but I don't know that we have the word for it yet.
we'll still be working on that, I guess. Before we get, that does kind of touch on, I think, where we're going with this conversation. But before we jump into that, would you tell people a little bit about, you know, your career and how you got to where you are now?
Yeah, well, you know, the topic of this pod is strategy. And in terms of how I got here, it was a very weird route, because growing up as a kid, I think like any kid, I had no idea what strategy was. I didn't want to become a strategist really at any formative point. I kind of stubbed my toe on strategy. I was doing English language and literature at college and loving that. And I thought I was going to be an academic. That was my initial idea of future Neil, was like I would be a don or something in the halls of academia. But I needed a summer job, and my Anglo-Saxon tutor connected me to her boyfriend, who just bust out of McKinsey to found his own strategy firm. And he offered me a job for the summer. I was like, okay, I'll do that. And to my complete surprise, I loved it. This was business strategy, so like classic McKinsey style business strategy. But I found that I was able to work on stuff that had consequence. I loved the problem solving. And I built my initial career there as a business strategy consultant. I started to get itchy at a certain point, like I was missing the poetry. Yeah. And like, what was the role for imagination and creativity, because classical business strategy consulting is so analytical and linear. Right. You're extrapolating the past into the future. And so I started to feel like, well, how do I get a little more of that? Serendipitously, it's one of those random events. IBM bought the company that I was working at, and I took a detour into corporate strategy in IBM, in that case, doing new business creation based on things that IBM research was inventing, text analytics, an early version of the current AI, being one. Wow. And then left IBM because I wanted to get even more creative, and took a job at Wolf Olins as chief strategy officer there. And that got me into the really into the brand game for the first time, bringing a business sensibility to it, but fascinated by, Wolf Olins, the high priests of graphic design, back then and still, today to an extent, bringing that notion of creativity and business together. And then that kind of propelled me into founding Co, because that I started to feel the limits within visual identity of, like, that wasn't really how brands were being built at that time. Like Google in its earliest incarnation had like literally the worst logo.
It was just kind of cracked out.
Yeah. I think it was done in Word, right? It was like done in Microsoft Word in different colors. And then met Rosemary Ryan and Ty Montague, who just bust out of JWT and were starting their own thing. And we had a meeting of minds around how to build a new agency consultancy partner, fully in the space around how do you build brands in a post-visual identity, post-communications, you know, environment. And that was the founding premise of Co, to do that in a new way together.
Yeah, and part of Co was built around the idea of action. And it wasn't just, you can't just say this is who we are. You have to prove it. You have to take action. You have to do things in the world to put that premise, bring that premise to life for your brand versus look at this ad. It's inert, but trust us.
Yeah, it's like the notion of action and experiences. It was clear, I think, you know, this is 2010. It was clear that a new generation of brands was being founded in action and experience. So like I mentioned, Google, Starbucks was another. Neither of these brands advertised at all in their early going.
Right.
We were fascinated by this, you know, phenomenon. And I think one of the, to put it really simply, one of the early ideas behind starting Co was all the companies from a professional services standpoint, the companies that were good at branding weren't good at experiences, right? So the classical ad agencies and the companies that were good at experiences, like let's say, you know, IDEO, Frog, or even, you know, venture backed startups with industrial design weren't good at brand. And so it's like, how do you, you know, bring those two together into a shared thought? And that became a new, I think a new kind of strategy discipline. It was thinking both about action and experience as well as brand and communications and culture simultaneously. Those two things hadn't historically, you know, bumped into each other in the same shop in that kind of way.
When you got engaged in brand at Wolf Olin, you obviously were exposed to brand prior to that. But when you took that position there in hip deep, you know, you really kind of started there in a little bit in the deep end there. What was your exposure to brand at IBM? You know, how much of a part of your work was it?
Brand was kind of alongside what I was doing. So I was in the IBM, very siloed, you know, at that time. I was in the corporate strategy team. Now, John Awata was, who's, you know, since become both a client and now a mentor, was running, you know, a really iconic marketing communications department on the floor below. But we never really communicated. And so I was creating new business ideas under the IBM brand, you know, all up. And I think hopefully adding a little to it in terms of innovation wasn't a discipline that I engaged in. I was more kind of an active consumer. And I thought about it a lot through the lens of the semiotics that I'd learned, you know, doing English at college. That was kind of one of the ways that I was processing it. But it wasn't a thing I was really doing at IBM. I was really doing business creation.
Well, I think semiotics is a great place to start, because especially if you think about traditional approaches to brand, it is about figuring out the roots of words, figuring out the sentiment, the intent of the words, and then trying to pull those as a through line through any kind of communication. And it was always through packaging or broadcast that we were trying to get people to see those words. And it's like, oh, these are all action verbs. This must be a fitness brand, or, you know, a lot of branding did come from that place. Where did you talk a little bit about how you see the past of brand, the past of brand and some of the foundational stuff that we've seen going by the wayside a little bit?
Yeah. I think it's been on my mind a lot is that it's clear, I think, to everyone that this is a moment where brands need to step up in new ways. And I think the problem that we have centrally is that the theories and practices of how brands are built and businesses are run were all created in an earlier age and don't work in this age. And we need an all new theory and practice that is still being built and doesn't exist yet.
Yeah.
And it's therefore instructive to look at that earlier age and say, okay, so what were the codes that were built into this practice of branding that we've now, you know, inherited? When you look into the deep past, it's interesting because branding's been going on like since forever. In fact, it's pre-human. I had my team think about like, what are the earliest instances of branding that you can think of? One of my team members said, well, you know, bees and hornets, like yellow and black as a code of danger in nature. It's kind of a visual identity, right? Yeah. It's like,
and a very helpful one.
Right? Very helpful. You immediately spot it. You read the code just as you would, you know, read a pack of Lucky Strike. And there are even, you know, insects that don't sting at all that are adopting that branding, you know, as their cover. And, you know, branding is ancient in human history. I think the Romans were obsessed with this this wine brand Falernium. You know, there are markings on bottles that are showing their origin. So branding is a thing that we do, like attaching signifiers to objects to understand them, right?
Mm-hmm. And navigate the world. Set them apart, yeah.
Set them apart, right. That's all ancient. I think the era that we're inheriting, though, is something very different. It was one that really started with patent medicines, where suddenly the packaging became the value. It wasn't somehow a signal of the inherent value. The packaging became everything. So in the, 19th century, you get patent medicines arising, especially in the US, but also in the UK, where it's all about the bottle and the label and the claim. What's inside is largely worthless, or generic. But then out of that, literally came Kellogg's, Coca-Cola. They were kind of patent medicine brands in their early going.
That's the roots of Kellogg's, yeah.
Totally, right? Like as a health resort and right. Cornflakes were a thing that people were fed. So out of that history, you get some of these iconic packaged goods brands. But that logic of it's the wrapper that is the value, and therefore the packaging and the communications are where we put the majority of our effort, right, to co-opt consumption. And then that became turbocharged. As I, look at it, in the post-war era, there was this amazing era of economic abundance. There was kind of a cultural mass center that, by the way, excluded a lot of people who now need to be listened to, but it was much more homogenous culturally. Mm-hmm. There were mass platforms, like you could get, God knows how many millions of eyeballs by just taking an ad in I Love Lucy. And there was a lack of consequences for consumption. There wasn't a sense that we were really damaging the world around us and the environment. And in those conditions, this notion of the branding being, the turbocharger of consumption ran riot globally, as we all know. And now we're hitting, the problems that that led to. But along the way, I think it professionalized this notion of branding is communications. Branding is positioning. It's not the thing itself. It's how do I position, how do I position this phone to you to put it in the best rhetorical light?
Right.
All of those practices, that's what you said about language, were born in that era. But they don't help us in this new era because they're all about, let's call it, psychological manipulation, rhetoric, share gain and shareholder value as the things that we're doing, not genuinely meeting people, helping people understand them, delivering value for broader, constituencies. So I think that the past has trapped us, and what's being taught in MA programs, MBA programs today is that older technology, and it doesn't really work in today's era.
Well, does it not work, or is there a place where it will bump into, it won't be sustainable anymore?
Yeah, that's a good point. It kind of runs out of gas, and it can, it can eat itself. You can end up just being irrelevant if you only follow that. I think what we experience, our clients facing, or a lot of companies face, is that they know that they need to be purpose driven, right? I think that there's a consensus around that, right? When the Business Roundtable announced it in 2019, and these were like some of the biggest companies in the Fortune 500, it's like, okay, we've all said we need to be purpose led. But that's a statement of intent that I think has as much value as we're going to be carbon neutral by 2040. Right. It's how do you actually do it? And I think what's happened is alongside this massive edifice of the shareholder value business machine, a few little tents have been camped of like how to do purpose-driven business.
Yeah, and they tend to be on the side,
right? It's a hobby for the business. Now, it's a good thing. I'm not dissing it. Please, we need more of it.
Something's better than nothing.
But it tends to be a departure from the business system, and therefore it can be defunded to the extent that it's funded. The next step, I think, would be to figure out how to actually bake purpose activation into the business itself and have that be the operations rather than the operations funding the altruism that enacts the purpose. And that's the step that I think hasn't quite been taken.
Yeah. I like what the analogy of runs out of gas for the current method in the environment that we're in and where it looks like we may be heading with, environmental change, war, water. So As we leg that out and as we think forward a few years, have you been thinking at all about how brand building or approach to brand might adapt, when it's not buy, but you know, we're adapting to a more turbulent world around us.
Yeah, that's been, you know, on our mind a lot at Coa. We're trying to build that and develop it, and we're not there yet, but I think that we have some, you know, some clues as to how that can, you know, can and should evolve. I think that the first one would be just taking the step of including more needs in, you know, decision making. That the classical, the minute that you're talking about ROI, you're talking about enriching shareholders, right? Because it's a return on investment, and the return goes where? And broadening that lens, you know, to take the business roundtable at its word and say we need to think more broadly about more constituents, more participants in the impact of this brand, the communities that are adjacent to the brand, the culture that the brand contributes to, the environment that the brand both pulls from and then pushes outputs back into. All of those things need to be considered. So, and that sounds great. Okay, let's think about those things. But the problem is, it's much harder to measure them, right? It's pretty easy to measure shareholder enrichment. Right. It's hard to measure positive or negative cultural impact and to get the feedback loops in place.
How do you even, where do you start?
Yeah, so, you know, because we're co and collaboration is core to what we do, we're having conversations with people who are researching these things. One collaboration that we're engaging in is with John Awata, who's at the Yale School of Management. And it's interesting that that school is called the School of Management, not the School of Business, because he's really interested in, like, what are the new managerial practices that aren't just business, right? They become right. Bigger, societal, and environmental. And John has been working on really building a toolkit for stakeholder capitalism and how you think about what that is. That's in progress, and we're assisting with that. And there's a whole toolkit that needs to be, you know, built out. That's one thing that's happening. Another one that I think is crucial to that point about how it's hard to measure things. There's a firm called Volutus that does really detailed supply chain measurement, and we're starting to partner with them on how we can think about baking those metrics into how you look at brand, you know, brand impact. We're not just thinking about the environment as a dimension in the abstract, which is never going to win an argument, but you can actually look at measures of how, for example, just to pick one case study from them, sustainability efforts are usually their value is undermeasured by a factor between 10 and 100 because things like, for example, the benefit of on consumer preference of sustainability efforts isn't calculated. Mm-hmm. It's just looking at media, you know, cost. So there are new valuation techniques and metrics that need to be built, and there are partners that are building that. There are new managerial tools that need to be built, and we have partners that are looking at that. But it's going to be a multidisciplinary effort. And my conviction is we need to kind of replace the toolkit, right? That actually strategy consulting that I used to do helped to build, right? All of these matrices and ways of making decisions.
Yeah.
Get that rebuilt in fundamentally involves more people, including, by the way, you know, design thinking, right? So human-centered design, who's the human? Which humans get to participate in that?
You know, how do we include more a wider array of voices that are impacted by these decisions than just either the shareholders or the core customer?
Exactly. So it's a whole set of new habits and behaviors. The toolkit is still being built to do that.
That's amazing. So how much of the old technology and the original toolkit do you think will be turned upside down? Are you, as you're looking at the new toolkit, is it adding to, is it a yes and, like, all these things are good plus all these new things, or is it, this has to go, you know, are there elements that you're thinking will get turned off as you add some of these new pieces?
I mean, so far it's just been additive, right, Adam? And I think that's in the early going, that's probably the only way that you can do it, because you can't tell a company that is, you know, listed on the New York Stock Exchange to ignore the shareholder dimension. You can't do that.
And in fact, they have a 20-year longitudinal study, you can't be like, stop that, and we're going to do this new thing today. Yeah.
So it needs to start by being additive. I think the fundamental point I would make is that we want to build these tools that add perspective to how companies make decisions and think about value and think about the impact of their brands.
Yeah.
But the hope would be that they evolve to being actually in harmony with the earlier profit-based model rather than acting against it. Because if they're not in harmony with it, in other words, if you can't make money off these new practices, to put it really, you know, bluntly, you'll probably not keep on doing them. I think one of the traps that we've been in is that a lot of businesses have been forced to think about purpose as an a drain of resources that they have to make for cultural reasons because their employees demand it. We've got to do this, as opposed to thinking about purpose as something that can, to the point about sustainability, generate value into the business. Or thinking empathetically about people can also be thought of as a concession. You know, we're allowing you know, employees to limit hours or being flexible with work location. But again, that reaps benefits in terms of a more committed and engaged and less exhausted workforce. So the vision that we have, and we're playing with calling this being a generative company, is that profit and purpose and people actually help each other, right? That profit can fund purpose, but purpose can create new constituencies of allegiance and loyalty that fund back to profit. Both of those can connect to people because people are motivated by engaging in a purpose, and because profit can reward those people. So from the little tent that we discussed on the outside of the edifice, right, that like purpose is somehow this ancillary thing, to it being part of the business system.
Yeah.
I think is the trick. And I got to be honest, we're building that and we're trying to figure out what that means. But it is additive, but it's additive in a way that's synergistic, not additive in a way that is, you know, in tension with the profit motive, we believe.
Yeah. And in a lot of cases, that purpose gets treated as a PR piece that is at optimally, you know, self-funding and not a cost center, which is a disaster. You know, then it just means it loses $1 and somebody wants to cut it.
No, it's, and I think we've all seen, right, the Instagram participation in social justice, for example, of so many companies, or the Instagram participation in moments like Ukraine. And it's just, it's eye rolling. You know, my younger team members would call it cringe. The issue is, don't, you know, cultural participation from the sidelines and just like saying yes doesn't cut it. Everyone knows this. This leads to another tool, right, which is much needed, which is, how does a company understand where it does have the right to intervene? Where should it enact its purpose? And to us, that should be the overlap between a real need in a constituency, but also a company's like genuine ability to help. Like, it should, how can this business, our business system, actually make, you know, a contribution there? And those are places to start. A great example is just a small one, is Capital One, you know, at a moment where, you know, income inequality is rising, they're handling people's money, they canceled overdraft fees. Mm-hmm. And that will create, you know, more longevity relationship for them. I'm sure that they had a good business reason to do it. But it's a wonderful example of financial services firms using their business system to actually assist people to get wealthier rather than simply, you know, draining them on the sides for misusing it, you know. And that's just one example. You know, H&M has been, I think last year, was offering a free suit rental for people who are applying for jobs that needed professional attire who couldn't afford it.
That's a nice idea.
Part of their business, right? Yeah. And we can contribute in a way that's, you know, authentic to them. You know, Google, a client of ours, we helped them in the pandemic, like the first pandemic summer, really communicate to small businesses how they could use Google's free tools to communicate new opening hours, new availability, curbside pickup, what the rules were for masking or not inside the business. All of this for free, but it really enabled businesses to present themselves in the right way to a world turned upside down. But again, fully part of Google because of the Google Maps, you know, imprint, and the fact that each business has its own, you know, place on Google Maps. So that idea of purpose not being philanthropy, but being a business action, I think is a fundamental.
It seems, you know, for those three companies you just mentioned, they have an experiential component. You know, the Capital One has, you know, about as experiential as it gets because it's your money and your blood pressure goes up when you look at that and you have to use the overdraft. Yeah. H&M, you're in a store or you're eventually going to put those clothes on your body. And then Google Maps is very active product, despite being pixels. But going back to consumer packaged goods, or, you know, the first patent medicines that you referenced earlier, and we don't have to use any specific brands, when those are sitting on a shelf and you're talking to a CMO or a brand manager, that, and I've worked on some of those brands where really it is, you said, and correctly, like the packaging becomes the value and the packaging becomes the brand. Yeah. It's hard to, even owning it myself, it's hard to come up with an idea that really makes sense for how they can engage in the world more broadly. That is not a PR stunt or not just a, you know, some sort of, you know, brand activation, and is genuinely enriching people or improving people's value given to them by that purchase.
Yeah. That's such a profound point. And it's interesting that the most powerful modern brands today are experiential brands. And as we, you know, discussed earlier, the technology was all built around packaged goods. I think it is hard for some of those. But even in categories like, you know, toiletries, right? I think that Dove has created, has really made a cultural contribution to self-esteem, definitions of beauty, self-image, that has had a lasting impact and a beneficial impact. And even though you can say that is adjacent to rather than baked into what they make, it's still, I think, it's created a new mindset with which those products are consumed, and you know, a new purpose for consuming them, not to hit an ideal, to express oneself, that has moved culture forward. And I look at that work, and that's, as you know, that's like a decades long effort, right? What Dove has been doing.
20 plus years, yeah.
20 plus years, right. So, I think in that sense, they've moved culture forward. And that, I think, takes me to another thing that I bump into a lot, which is a lot of the traditional communications-driven brand building has historically exploited culture, right? It's looked at, and planners do this for a living, like, where, what can we, like, using culture as our, you know, leverage point? I think Andrew Keller, back when he was at CPB, said that we diagnose culture to manipulate culture. Which yeah, is yeah, how like he put what it was.
Looking for soft spots that we can plug, you know, the brand into. Yeah,
exactly. And to me, like, again, like the bigger point is, instead of strip mining past culture, right, or looking at current culture of what you can co-opt, how can you move culture forward? Like, what in culture do you want to be a solution to? So even if you're just making toothpaste and it's, you know, it's not an immersive business experience that, where you can really shift people's behavior, because probably the role of toothpaste in people's lives is a relatively solved proposition. There are still questions of how you can evolve culture and think about contributing to the culture that we all want to be a part of, and bake that into the work. So I think the cultural job of marketers shifts in this new era to how do we move culture forward, not what can we kind of grab as a sticky point for a brief, you know, in current culture that we can kind of glom onto.
How you're dealing with leaders at these companies, how tough of a sell is that to, you know, it's one thing to get someone to commit to a new package design or a campaign or even a purpose driven effort, but to get them to understand and comprehend, like, no, we're going to get our arms around culture and we're going to decide together what part of culture we want to improve or impact.
Yeah.
That's a huge ask, is it not?
We don't find that, Adam, to be honest with you. We get, and it may be that we, you know, self-select a bit because we're so much into that end of the market that clients
come
to us.
That's the service they come to you for.
You know, so we find it's more that they don't know how to do it. Like, they'll come to us with the willingness. We worked with an apparel retailer who was all about, how do we bake this evolving redefinition of masculinity into our brand? They wanted to contribute to that. They didn't know how to do it. And so often we're the agents of how rather than the agents of what. You know, as I said, I think if you speak to most relatively, you know, aware business practitioners today, they know that businesses have to follow a purpose. Yeah. I think that is sold. Like, the question is how, and we tend to be more answering the how question than the whether we should, you know, question. Whether that's, you know, by luck or because that's the kind of business we get, or because the general climate has shifted that far, which I hope is the case. We don't finally get into that argument. It's more the argument about the activation and the how.
Which do you think takes more vision? The the what or the how? I used to think it was the what, but now in my, in this part of my career, I think someone who has the patience to look at the field and say, and we can move this over here and we can plug this in over there. What's your experience with it? Where does the vision really live?
I think the how is harder. I think visions are, you know, visions are relatively, you know, cheap. And so that's why, you know, partly our emphasis on action, you know, figuring out exactly how this intent cascades through into the business. And that's actually, interestingly, that's led us to reorganize, you know, Co, because given that purpose is at the core and most businesses now agree they need to be purpose driven, the question of how you do it requires different kinds of action. And mm-hmm. so we stopped being one kind of offering and have now evolved into three for that reason. Kate Krugman, who you spoke to a couple of years ago,
yep.
founder of our organization and culture practice, you know, the how of purpose becomes, well, how do you actually get employees to fully believe it, know what it is, know how to act on it, engage with it, and use that genuinely as a cultural touchstone. There's an entire practice of organizational psychology, organization design, even structuring incentives, rewards, rituals, and behaviors that you need to engage in to do that well. So we've actually created a practice that does that with specialists, you know, in that field. Business and brand, how does purpose actually manifest in how you literally architect your brands for a major sports retail that we've worked with? We're building a new brand architecture that actually activates their purpose as the brand architecture, so you can encounter it through the products and understand, you know, how it relates. So baking it into business and brand practice, and that's another of our offerings. And then lastly, and you mentioned this experience, like how do you bake that into the experience? And that takes intersectional design of digital design, you know, product design, service design. How does the purpose actually manifest in the experience that you offer day to day? You need specialists, you know, in that. So it's certainly pushing us to become more about the how than the what, although we still do a lot of the what. Purpose definition is still part of it.
Oh,
but
sure. Yeah.
Where I think we're really propulsive to our clients is in the how that manifests.
Yeah.
Inside the business with, you know, organ culture, outside the business with experiences, and in the business on the brand itself.
Yeah, I think I asked you the question in an unfair way too, because not all visions are equal, and not all executions are equal either. You know, so some are definitely more complex or grander in scale or effort. Yeah.
Well, I think that takes us to an interesting area around purpose design, because that's another theory. It's as though all purposes are, you know, birthed equal. I think I'm going to misquote this, Adam, but I think that British American Tobacco's purpose is something like to increase human happiness. I think it's something like that.
It sounds like an amazing purpose.
And it's like, okay, good luck. You know, so there are businesses that they've called it at such a high level that there's no credibility in how they can achieve that, right? It's just puffery.
Yeah.
There are others whose purpose is to become the dominant provider of widgets in, you know, northeastern Saskatchewan or whatever that may be, that are too low level. The trick is defining a purpose that is something that you can actually achieve with the business system that you either have or want to evolve into,
yes,
and that's at the right kind of, you know, altitude. And that is much trickier to do.
And I think it is fair for a company to say, our purpose is to make money and return shareholder value. If they want to say that publicly, and I'm not really a libertarian, but the market will decide if that's the best way to attack it, or if this other organization that has a different purpose is better for them.
Yeah.
And what's frustrating about the conversation around purpose, which as a Twitter user, it gets distilled down to 280 characters, is like, it's binary. It's good or bad.
Right.
Well, no, it's obviously not. It's much more complex than that.
Yeah.
But
and not all of them are good, and not all of them are fit for purpose. You know, a question we ask in the work we do is your purpose fit for purpose? Because if the purpose is actually driving credible action and making a difference, you've got to pitch it at a certain altitude.
Yes.
And I think to your point about, you know, there are companies that just want to say, yeah, you know, we're here to make money. They absolutely should do that. I think where they'll run into problems the soonest is with hiring, because new talented employees, it's a cliche to say, but it doesn't make it not true. They want to work for purpose-led companies where they feel that they can actually have a hand in enacting that purpose. And if you're not offering that as part of employer value proposition, your talent will be worse. You'll have dumber people. You won't in the long term, you know, sustain, because you'll lose the war for talent. That's just the starting dimension, you know, of all of this, of why it's actually self-interest that would take you there.
Yeah, I want to go back to the very beginning of this. I introduced CoCollective, and I stumbled over agency or consultancy we talked about. And then we've just had this long conversation about brand and about what you're building there or evolving Co to do. So both of those words are loaded with baggage. And how do you, how does that inform the decisions you make about how you're building Co and how you're staffing it in those three areas that you're building? Because it doesn't, you didn't describe anything that sounds like an agency to me.
The agency part is that we deeply believe in creativity. Mm-hmm. And it's the thing that led me to want to leave strategy consulting. Creativity, imagining what could be, not extrapolating what is, mm-hmm. being unreasonably ambitious, believing in the ability of creative thought to shift things forward in completely discontinuous ways. We fully commit to that. We have creative teams working alongside strategy teams. We think that that dialogue is absolutely essential to what we do. So,
and those are like traditional creative teams?
Those are more intersectional than that. So it's a blend of graphic designers, service designers, systems thinkers, copywriters, creative directors, but it's a motley and awesome crew of like different skills that are in the creative realm. So we're agency like in that, like, dogged belief in the power of creativity. We think it's absolutely fundamental, because a purpose has to light people's hearts up. There has to be a creative dimension to that. Businesses need to be creative enterprises to fully deliver value. We're consultancy like in that we believe in rigor. Right, we believe in really grounding what we do in fact based, and that not only gives it a higher chance of being right, but also is immensely propulsive in any C-suite conversation. You can win the argument at the CEO and CFO level if you have that fundamental grounding. But it's the two together, and that leads us not to want to use either word. It's a transformation partner is how we think of it.
Oh, that's great. Well, Neil, it was wonderful to spend this time with you. Thank you so much for joining me. I really appreciate it.
Thanks a lot, Adam. Yeah, really enjoyed it.
Where can people find you online?
Neil Parker on Instagram will be the place.
Got it. That's it. You're a one platform person.
Yeah.
I love it. I will add a link in the show notes. Neil, thanks again for joining me. This is a wonderful conversation.
Awesome. All right. Cheers, Adam.
Thanks, bud. That was
thanks
great.
Thanks a lot. Bye.
Strategy Inside Everything is produced by me, Adam Pierno. If you like what you've heard, leave a review wherever you listen to podcasts. Actually, I have no idea if that helps or if it's ever done anybody any good. If you really want to help the show and you like what you've heard, share it with someone else you think will dig it. That's the best way to help the show and keep the conversation growing. If you have an idea, a question, or want to push back, go to thatsnotaninsight.com, where you can send me a message or leave me a voicemail that will be added to future shows. Music for the Strategy Inside Everything is by Saw Square Noise. For more information on me, you can go to adampierno.com to learn about my books, my speaking, and my consulting practice. Thanks for listening.